Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblad, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, one of our favorite guests is here with us. It's Salman Rushdie, who has written an otherworldly novel called 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. Is it fair to translate that?
Yes. I mean, it's a 1,001 nights. In fact, I just found myself wondering, when thinking about the 1,001 nights, and what is that in English, so to speak, and worked it out, and then found myself pleased by the fact that there was a kind of symmetrical number hidden inside the famous number, you know, so the 2, 8, 28. Of course, people already are delighting in telling me that it doesn't work if there's a leap year.
Whereas the 1,001 nights happen just once in history, the Sultan has been killing a virgin a night, and along comes Scheherazade and her little sister, Dunyazade, and they are capable of the wonderful word ensorceling the Sultan. Mm-hmm. Scheherazade begins to tell a story, and Dunyazade, late in night, just when the monster is about to pounce, says, "Oh, Sherry, it's so late. Let's continue this tomorrow night." And so she saves the lives of all of the virginal young women for 1,001 nights, by which time the Sultan has married her, has children with her, and is still awaiting the end of the story. Well, the big revelation in Salman Rushdie's book is that the 1,001 nights happen over and over and over again in history. There are thousands of 1,001 nights, yes?
Yeah, in this book, there's at least 3 sets of them, you know, in each of which there's, if you like, a kind of story arc, one in the past, one in the present, one in the future.
Now, give me a clue. When you've got a book where the story is going to be complicated, how do you go about making it malleable and memorable so that a reader, in this case, I read this book with a kind of giddiness. I was skating all over it. It was like a thrilling roller coaster for me.
Well, I mean, look, this book came together in 2 ways, I think, that to answer your question, that one part of it is to really understand what the through line of the book is. It's a thing that, you know, when I've had students, I've said to them about writing that, whose story are you telling? You know, and if you know whose story you're telling, then that becomes your thread that guides you through the maze. So I was always quite clear about that the story was about 2 people. The story was about Dunya, the fairy princess, and Mr. Geronimo, her descendant, the many generations removed descendant of her love affair with this 12th century philosopher Ibn Rushd, who actually rather looks like Ibn Rushd, and who she sort of falls in love with as an echo of the man she once loved. So those 2, and he's this Kafkaesque figure, you know, of a gardener who mysteriously and inexplicably gets unstuck from the earth. I had them very clearly all the way through, and I just tried to follow them through the book. A lot of the rest of it really developed in a way by trial and error. You know, I mean, there were some of these stories that surround the central story that I'd had around for quite a long time. And then I suddenly thought, oh, well, that fits here, that fits there. But I also tried going down alleyways and then thinking, I don't want to be here. And discarding material and trying again in another direction. So it came together in this strange way.
Well, what's spectacular about it is that this book offers a solution, or at least a panacea, to contemporary feelings of incoherence, mm-hmm. of wondering who we are, where we're going,
and what's going on.
And what's going on? What in the world is happening? And it's a novel that risks that oldest fashioned thing, a happy ending. Not just a happy ending for its characters, but for humanity itself.
Yes, happy-ish ending.
Well, I don't know, Salman, when you seem to tell us that with the vanquishing of the dark genies, jinn, and the sealing of the world between fairyland and our world, that we can conquer climate change because their anger and fury has brought about solar heating, we are really, at the end of this book, facing a grand new tomorrow.
Yes, that may be the true fantasy of the novel, that it speculates about a brighter future than maybe we have any right to expect right now.
Yes, and I'm so impressionable that I'm buying it whole hog, except in its last paragraphs we're told that the price we'll have to pay for banning the fairies and the djinn to their world is that stories, imagination, may disappear. We may be stuck now having to deal practically with reality. No more made-up gods. No more divisiveness on the basis of religious cultures. We're going to have to learn, how to be rationalistic creatures of a new enlightenment.
I know, yeah, be careful what you wish for, you know.
Which
is always good advice when you're dealing with the djinn, by the way.
I don't want to live without stories.
No.
I mean, this book, everything about it seems to me to be right. It begins with the famous Goya epigraph, El sueño de la razón produce monstruos, the sleep of reason brings forth monsters. We're told that we're living in a time of the sleep of reason. How did we get genie?
Well, because the djinn is the plural, right? So the djinn is the name of the tribe. The individual male djinn is called a jinni. So the jinni is singular. And so from jinni comes genie.
And the female version
is a jinnia.
And our queen of the jinnia is
Dunya.
Dunya. They're always having sex, these djinns. But she's one of the few who has, not only has sex with humans, but falls in love.
Falls in love and has babies.
Many babies. Mm. And she considers them to be a tribe. Mm. The Dunyazat.
Dunyazat. The word zat just means a race or a tribe, yes.
And so over the thousands of years since she has been the matriarch of her tribe, having as many as 2, 3 to 11 babies at a time.
19 on one occasion.
She gives birth to a tribe, and when the slits between worlds open again, well, of course, what mother would not want to see what's become of her children, her children's children, and her great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren? And so Dunya becomes the heroine who's there to lead them in rescuing Earth from the dark djinn.
Yes, she becomes like a sort of mother goddess.
Let's hear about the sex lives of the djinn. This is from 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, a novel by Salman Rushdie.
The djinn are not noted for their family lives, but they do have sex. They have it all the time. There are djinn mothers or fathers, but the generations of the djinn are so long that the ties between the generations often erode. Djinn fathers and daughters, as will be seen, are rarely on good terms. Love is rare in the djinn world, but sex is incessant. The djinn, we believe, are capable of the lower emotions, anger, resentment, vindictiveness, possessiveness, lust, especially lust, and even perhaps some forms of affection. But the high, noble sentiments, selflessness, devotion, and so on, these elude them. In this, as in so much else, Dunya proved herself exceptional. Nor do the djinn alter greatly with the passage of the years. For them, existence is purely the business of being, never becoming. For this reason, life in the djinn world can be tedious, except for the sex. Being, by its nature, is an inactive state, changeless, timeless, eternal, and dull, except for the non-stop sex. This is why the human world was always so attractive to the djinn. The human way was doing. The human reality was alteration. Human beings were always growing and shriveling and striving and failing and yearning and envying, acquiring and losing and loving and hating and being, in sum, interesting. And when the djinn were able to move through the slits between the worlds and meddle in all this human activity, when they could tangle or untangle the human web and accelerate or hold back the endless metamorphosis of human lives, human relations, and human societies, they felt paradoxically more like themselves than they ever did in the static world of fairyland. It was human beings who allowed the djinn to express themselves, to create immense wealth for lucky fishermen or imprison heroes in magic webs, to thwart history or enable it, to take sides in wars between the Kurus and Pandavas, for example, or the Greeks and Trojans, to play Cupid or to make it impossible for a lover ever to reach his beloved, so that she grew old and sad and died alone at her window waiting for him to arrive. We now believe that the long age in which the djinn were unable to interfere in human affairs contributed to the ferocity with which they re-entered it when the seals between the worlds were broken. All that pent-up creative and destructive power, all that good and bad mischief burst upon us like a storm. And between the djinn of white magic and the djinn of black magic, the bright djinn and the dark, an enmity had grown in their Peristan exile, and human beings became the surrogates upon whom their hostility played itself out.
Salman Rushdie reading from relatively, 20, 30 pages into his new novel, 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights. In other words, dare we say it, 1,001 nights. Dunya has come back to Earth. She's found the great, 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 etc. grandchild who looks most like the philosopher she originally fell in love with. Mm-hmm.
And that's Mr. Geronimo the gardener. And so they have sex too. One of the interesting things about the djinn is that they have no incest taboo. It simply doesn't occur to them that that's a problem. One of the places from which I learned about creatures that lack incest taboos is camels. Camels don't have an incest taboo. In fact,
camels have sex with their children?
With their mothers and effortlessly.
How did you learn this?
Because there was a time in my life when I was in Australia with somebody who had camels, and I discovered this. In fact, there was the comic end of the story is that there was a camel that that had sex with its mother, and a child was produced. And because I was there, the child was named after me.
My goodness.
So somewhere in Australia, there's a camel called, in Australian accent, Selman.
And you are named after a character in this book.
Yes.
The original philosopher, he's a Aristotelian who to this day we know of as Averroes.
Yes, but in the Arabic from which that's a Latinization is Ibn Rushd.
R-U-S-H-D. Yeah. So as I read, I was continually saying Rushdie. How does this come to be your name?
Well, because my father chose it. You know, my grandfather wasn't called it. And my grandfather had a long, elaborate, kind of old Delhi kind of name. And my father, trying to, that is, modernize the family, felt there should be a more straightforward surname. And he admired the philosophy of Ibn Rushd of Averroes and changed the family name to Rushdie, which means of Rushd, you know. And I only found out about this, I mean, I didn't know it as a child growing up. I found out about it later in life. And then, like, more or less when I was at university, I thought I'd better familiarize myself with this philosopher after whom we're all named. And I started reading his work, this wonderful book, that his great intellectual adversary, Ghazali, who is also a character of the book, had written this attack on philosophy called The Incoherence of the Philosophers. And Ibn Rushd wrote a response to it, which was rather wonderfully called The Incoherence of the Incoherence.
It's spectacular. You see, that's the origin of this book. If The Thousand and One Nights depends upon an arguing and adversary couple. Mm-hmm. The adversary couple that begins the novel 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights are two philosophers, one of whom believes in reason and coherence, and the other of whom believes in belief.
Blind faith.
Blind faith.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is has been forever.
Yeah,
that's the war over God.
Yeah.
The war over reality.
Yeah, the war about the nature of God is what it was about. Because Ibn Rushd certainly did not think of himself as ungodly. But he had an idea of God which was at odds with the traditionalists.
And so what we find is that this becomes the war of the two worlds.
Yes.
The world of the jinn, who want blind belief propelled by fury and anger, weather conditions going crazy, volcanic behaviors, and gravity itself failing in a very manic and peculiar way.
And unpredictable.
Unpredictable. One character finds himself only 3 inches above the ground, but he misses the ground.
Yeah.
He's a gardener. Why can't he walk on the grass in his garden? And so what we've got is Salman Rushdie writing his book 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights. And we'll continue after this short break.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Salman Rushdie about his latest book, 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, a richly engrossing tale that weaves characters from different times with ancient and contemporary mythology, as well as enduring romance. Well, this really at a time when people are really needing an understanding from a man of what might constitute a matriarchy. This is a woman coming back from centuries ago to rescue her progeny, male and female, giving them in some cases, extraordinary powers.
Or awakening the powers that they have as a result of their
being
origin.
Descendants of the jinn. Mm. And some of them are reconnected with their anger, furiously so. Others with a spirit of generosity. And so we watch in this book a woman moving, as women do, to save the world. She even induces a strike against sex, just like Lysistrata did. And even she tries to participate in the strike, but she is the first to break.
She's the first to crack.
She can't help it. She's a djinn. Yeah. She's a genia. And it's a magnificently comic novel about serious things.
Well, that's, I mean, I've always had a fondness for writing that somehow goes against the grain of the material, you know. So if there's a tragic moment, you try and write about it as black comedy, you know. And it's one of the things, really, that I think I learned above all from Kafka, you know, that we think of this thing, this characteristic that we call the Kafkaesque, as being very dark and weird and filled with foreboding and fear, you know. And so it is, because that's the world he's describing. But if you actually read his stuff, it's entirely written as comedy. If you read The Castle, every single scene, every single successive chapter of The Castle is composed as a comic scene. And yet the overall effect of it is unsettling in a profound way. So I thought, write a really funny book about a moment in the world's history which is not at all funny.
Well, I would say that you succeeded in both, but because I do like to escape into books, I found the escape here to be one of delight. I felt that the book, pardon me for being what people consider to be a naive reader, I felt the book was rescuing me from a lot of harrowing and unbearable questions about the future of Earth and how our subsequent generations will be able to live on it. Can there be anything more ambitious for a novelist to take on?
Well, first of all, I don't think anybody with a brain would call you a naive reader, Michael. So I think you're safe from that allegation. But I, you know, yes, I mean, it's the book, given that the book is not, you know, 1,000 pages long, it does attempt to be not just a portrait of the human race, but also a portrait of the salvation of the human race. And its arrival at a kind of Whitman-esque point of celebration.
Yes, and the celebration has something to do with why we tell ourselves stories, why we like to scare ourselves, and what the rescue is from terror. Mm-hmm. The rescue is the other part of the brain, a rational part of the brain, a skeptical part of the brain that refuses to indulge in dangerous belief.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's, I just thought, what I learned in a way from the study of history is that history is not written in advance. History is not a given. It's not determinist, you know. It's not inevitable that it will go in a certain direction, no matter how strongly it looks as if it may go in that direction. History is full of knight's moves and unexpected changes. And so I thought, instead of assuming about the world we now live in, that it will inevitably move in this endlessly darkening direction that it would be easy to believe that it might, I thought, what else can I imagine? What else can I imagine could happen to us if that were not it? And that means thinking about the best of humanity, not just the worst.
So the best of humanity does not live in a history that's doomed to repeat itself.
No.
The best of humanity is finding an escape from...
Well, finding the agency in oneself that allows oneself to change the world. No.
Is it possible to save the world?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's a work of fiction, Michael. But I wanted to at least allow the reader to understand the possibility that you could succeed against what oppressed you or what endangered you. You know, that the victory of evil is not inevitable.
Well, you're one of the few writers of any generation, well, since World War I, who would write a book that says the victory of evil is not inevitable. That's very enheartening. How do you manage to do it, or is it that you can't live if you don't believe that?
I think it's more, it is that, yes, but it's also, you know, just, I mean, the way in which this book, or the way in which that idea connects to my own personal experience is that it was quite clear to many people when the attack on me began that it would only end badly. You know, that there were many people convinced that it would end with an act of violence against me, you know. And I mean, there were acts of violence against other people, you know, but there was a general view, I think, unspoken, that this couldn't end well, you know. And yet, actually, it sort of did end well, you know. I mean, here I am, sitting across the table from you, not surrounded by men with machine guns, leading a perfectly ordinary life and having a future, you know. And there was a long period when I didn't believe that that would happen. But to get it back was just a way of showing me the truth of what I've just said to you.
It's amazing. When you close your eyes, if you recast yourself into the realm of Arabian Nights stories, you're escaping on a flying carpet.
Yeah.
You know, you've made a miraculous escape, and somehow or other, the goons and bad guys have been more or less evaded. They are there. They send messages regularly.
But you know, flying carpets are available to us all, is the point.
We all can find our flying carpets. Yeah. I think that's a beautiful way to end for today. I've been talking with Salman Rushdie, author of 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, in other words, 1,001 nights, His Way, published by Random House. Thank you, Salman, for joining me again.
Thanks, Michael.
It's been a pleasure. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. My associate producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just baby this, 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 baby this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Bonnie Nadsom and Dale Jameson are our guests.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.